Welcome to this very special session of the Identity Festival of Ideas, which is a celebration of ideas, as you might guess. My name is Mick Luby, and I am a chair. I just want to say that because I find it funny, and that's what we're exploring today, funniness. When I left school many years ago, I never imagined I'd be a chair. A stool, maybe, but not a chair. Now, to help me today, three very special performers. First, the first two I shall introduce thus. Like the Perth Mint, she is a WA institution, only more entertaining. She is an actor, singer, dancer and writer. She's also one half of the comedy duo Black and Tran. She is Ningley Lawford Wolfe. He is a comic, an actor, a writer and creator of Barry Noodles, the first Vietnamese football star. He also happens to be the other half of Black and Tan, which is just as well. And he can be summed up in two words that make him the envy of many men. He's hung. And when he's not cracking jokes, he's seriously hung. Ladies and gentlemen, Hung Lee, Black and Tran.
Yo, Tokyo. You know, got a stick?
Moi?
Yeah, you want to have a game of pool?
Nah.
Oh, yeah, whatever then.
All right. But hey, I'm not Japanese, all right?
Yeah, okay. I'll just rack them up then, all right, Beijing? So, where are you from?
I'm from Nam, mofo.
True God. Vietnam.
No, Pakistan.
So how'd you get here then?
I took the train to Spencer Street.
No, how'd you get here, really? You know, to Australia?
Oh, here?
Yeah.
Oh, we swam.
Hey, did you see Susie Maroney on the way?
Susie Maroney, that's funny. No, we were following Susie Maroney. I'll get it.
That poor kid's run away.
No, we were following Susie Maroney, yeah, and when we got to the Philippines, she chucked a right-hand turn and we nearly ended up in Cuba. We had to chuck a Yui all the way back.
So what's your name?
Wong.
Nah, your real name, brass.
Tran. Jackie Tran. What's your name?
Black. Roberta Black. That don't take no flack.
So, what part of Africa are you from?
I'm from the Africa that broke away.
What?
No.
What?
I'm from here, Australia, born and bred.
Really? Where?
Fitzroy.
Hey, I know Fitzroy. Punters Club, right?
No, not Fitzroy, Victoria. Fitzroy Crossing, you know, in Western Australia?
No.
Do you know the Kimberleys?
No.
Do you know where Christmas Creek is?
Christmas Creek? No, we're Buddhists.
Do you know where Turkey Creek is?
No, we're vegetarian.
You don't know much about the bush then, do you?
Mate, I know shit about the bush. I've never been to the bush. I've been here 35 years, I've never seen a kangaroo. Except on the TV, you remember the one, the Bash Up Muddy Monster? Yeah, that one there, mate.
So you ever been up north?
Up north, yeah. I went to Darwin once. You know Darwin's up near you?
Yeah, just down the road from us.
Oh, really? Yeah, really? How far? Just
round the corner.
Round the corner, really. I went to Darwin, right? To see the jumping crocodiles. You heard of them?
Yeah.
Oh, man. You go there, right? You get on this boat, this glass boat, mm-hmm. and go down Adelaide River, right? Mm-hmm. and they've got a bucket full of pigs' heads, and they cut all these pigs' heads up, and they get a stick, and they tie a pig's head to the stick, and they dangle it in the water, and then the crocodile comes, and they pull the stick up, and the crocodile jumps and grabs the pig's head. It's unbelievable.
And now you know why pigs don't fly in Darwin, eh?
Yeah, shit. And if that doesn't work, you know what they do? They grab the nearest German. And everybody's happy.
Yeah, them crocodiles are like socks and sandals.
Yeah, they do. Can I ask you something?
Yeah.
So you people have been here 60,000 years, right? Is that right?
Yeah, well, last count, we've been here 60,250 years now.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's what they reckon. You know, they reckon when Aboriginal people came to Australia,
yeah,
the only domestic animal they brought with them was the dingo.
Hey, yum.
No, you would like this dingo, Bryce. We can bring Ernie Dingo.
Hey, oh, I'm not eating him. You know, our people, we've been here since the Stone Age.
True.
Yeah. You know, here you got like cave paintings.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we've got cave mathematics. Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, we invented cricket, you know.
True what?
Yeah. Cricket was invented by a really wise old Chinese man. His name was Deep Long On. We invented fire, do you know that?
Yeah, and how you do that?
Rub two chopsticks together.
Hey, your mob been in that war, eh? You know that Vietnam War? That's your mob.
Yeah, man, we've been thousands of years. We're professionals. You know how I'm the tallest Vietnamese guy you've ever seen?
Mm-hmm.
You want to know why?
Too much MSG?
Too much MSG, yes. Yeah. I'll tell you a story, man. It was like, phew. April 29th, last day of the Vietnam War, April 29th, 1975, we get this phone call, right? It says, you've got 3 hours to leave the country. So quickly, you know, we packed our bags, we fed the dog to Grandma. We loaded the car, we franked it down to the dock, we grabbed a slab of beer for the trip because, you know, there's a few of us. And so we set off in this old leaking prawn trawler. Man, this boat, I tell you, this boat was leaking so much, the prawns were shitting themselves. I'll tell you about this boat, man. We were on this boat. This boat, we had no food. There was no water, no karaoke. I was so hungry, I used to lie there and dream about crash landing in the Andes and having people to eat, you know. And so, you know, so we jumped on this boat, right? And it was just thousands and thousands of boats all parked right next to each other at Saigon Dock. So we had to climb on all these boats to get it to the last one. I had my feet, I was 9 years old, I had my feet on one boat and my hands on the other boat, and this wave hit and I just stretched like this. And then my dad started selling tickets for people to walk over me like this. Oh, it was unbelievable. And so we set off, man. So we set off, and we just had to jump on this barge. You know what a barge is?
No.
See, we ran out of fuel. Right in the middle of the ocean, we ran out of fuel. We had this barge. And a barge is a platform. It had fences all over it, packed with sandbags. And during the war, people used it to move guns and ammunition around. And after the war, people used it to transport people. So we had to jump on this barge, and we were sitting on this barge. We had no food, nothing, right? And people were starving, old people sitting around drinking their own urine and stuff like that. And then after a week, the American Navy picked us up, right? And they took us to the Philippines. So picture this, right? 10,000 starving Vietnamese refugees in black pajamas. And they put us in this queue, this single file, heading towards the food tent. And guess what they gave us?
What?
A cheeseburger and a Pepsi. Yeah, world's first Happy Meal, you know. And dessert was hot dogs. And we thought, yeah, you beauty, hot dogs, right? So I'm standing there, I've got mine, I'm standing there, and I'm looking at mine. And I said to the guy, I said, mate, this is disgusting. And he goes, what's wrong with it? And I said, well, in my country, we don't eat this bit of the dog, eh? And then we're in the Philippines, we're in Subic Bay, right, for one night, and the next night they flew us out to refugee camps. They built all these refugee camps on this tropical island called Guam. Guam was sort of like Club Med with barbed wire around it, right? And so we were on Guam for about 4 months, and we had a choice of either going to France, Canada, or Australia. And we didn't want to go to France because, well, you know, French people live there. We didn't want to go to Canada because, well, you know, French people live there. And so we picked Australia for the long weekends, right? So, and so we were one of the very first Vietnamese boat people in this country, right? So the government didn't know what to do with us, right? So the government decided to help us out, decided to give us an interpreter, you know, a translator, help us get our bank books and get our life together and stuff. You know how close they came to an English-speaking Vietnamese guy in Australia in 1975?
What?
They gave us a guy from Malta. Yeah, no shit. They thought, oh, yeah, Maltese, Vietnamese, close enough, right? For the first 5 years in this country, I thought Maltese was the official language of Australia.
You reckon you never spoke English? Mate, I didn't speak English until I was, like, I don't know, 14 years old.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. I learned to speak English from listening to country and western radio shows.
Really? Yeah? Man. We learn English from listening to the country eastern radio show.
What's country and eastern?
You never heard of country eastern?
No.
I'll show you country eastern. I'll sing you a country eastern song, right?
Yeah.
I'm crazy. Crazy for fearing so ornery. That, my friend, is country eastern. Yeah.
When I was growing up, country and western, in any outback towns, you know, whether it be in Tamworth, anywhere, big thing with all the black fellas, especially Aboriginal people. So, you know, we used to listen to country and western. We used to have this show called the Earl Reeves Hour. I was deadly. We used to write letters. We used to get heaps of, requests being read over the radio from all our mob in the prisons. And they used to write requests, and I used to listen to it all the time. See, we have this word in my language, buyu. And it means female genitalia. And when I was growing up, I used to hear this song and I sang, gee, they got Shane playing this song on the radio. You know? Saying things like that on the radio. There was a song, country and western song. It went like this. Would you sweet lips a little closer to the phone? Gave another meaning to a telephone section. But that was just one other time. We were all sitting around the fire, you know, playing guitar. My cousins were all sitting around. And my uncle come up to my cousin. He goes, hey, Buru. Buru, you can play mine that song, you know, that big horse song. And my cousin's going, what big horse song? I never hear no big horse song. Ah, you know that big horse song? Everybody know him, that big horse song. And we're thinking really hard. What big horse song? And my cousin turns around to my uncle and said, look, Gags, why don't you just sing that song, and if I know the tune, I'll play it on the guitar for you. Yeah, all right, my uncle reckoned. So he starts singing. Just big horse, I asked a friend about her. Just big horse, I spoke her name somewhere.
I like it.
And that's my friend. How I learned how to speak English, eh? So, how was Australia when you first got here then?
Oh, man. We didn't know what to eat when we came to Australia. You know, 1975 in Australia.
What do you mean you didn't know what to eat?
We didn't know what to eat. Well, there's no such thing as Chinese grocery shops in 1975, right?
Yeah, I suppose so.
So me and my mum went to the supermarket, right? We'd never been in a supermarket before, right?
Mm.
My mum came back from the supermarket the first day with a box of cornflakes. Right? So the whole family was sat around the dinner table trying to work it out, you know, because we couldn't read it because, you know, it wasn't in Maltese. And it's got a chicken on it, right? cornflakes have got a chicken on it, right? And so my mum works it out, you know. She's very smart, my mum, right? She works it out, right? She goes, oh, okay. Okay, I get it, okay. Okay, I get a piece of bread. I put some margarine on it. I put some cornflake on it. Some soy sauce. And send us off to school. Oh, man. Mate, the wogs are laughing at us. My dad ate cornflake sandwiches for 15 years. He had no idea, right? We didn't have the heart to tell him, right? So after 15 years, I told him, I sat him down, I said, Dad, listen, with cornflakes, you have to put it in a bowl and put Fanta in it and stuff, right? So, you know. So you know what we had to eat?
What?
Italian food.
Yeah?
And, you know, I don't mind Italian food, you know, your pizzas and your pasta and so on. But there's one thing about Italian food Asian people don't understand.
What's that?
And that's risotto. You know, that's... What is that stuff? You know what my mum reckons?
My mum reckons?
Risotto's Italian for who fuck up the rice.
But you know, in this country, they reckon us mob, you know, the Aboriginal people, they said that we never had a war, you know?
Yeah, really?
Yep, they reckon we just woke up one day and we just gave them the country. But we did. We had, you know, resistant fighters. We had Jandamara, who was a fighter in the Kimberley, in Boonuba country. And we had Pemulwuy, who was from New South Wales. And we had Yagan, who was from Western Australia. And most of those people today, you know, since they killed them, they chopped up their heads. And we never know where the bodies are today. They just chopped up their head and took them for scientific studies. Yeah. They reckon true. But one thing they gave us, religion. Oh, shit, they brought religion here in a big way. Yeah, they all turned up here. They told us, right? They come here with the Bible. They told us to close our eyes in prayer. When we woke up, we had the Bible and they had the land. Yeah, they said this country was terra nullius, that there was nobody here. But then where did I come from? You know, we've been here forever, bro. Yeah, Bible. Funny thing, the Bible. You heard that joke about Adam and Eve?
No.
Why do we know that Adam and Eve weren't Aboriginal?
Why?
Because they would have eaten the snake. But you know what? They used to show us these pictures when I was young about Christianity. There's a literally scary thing. I got really scared, you know, like going to Sunday school, because we never really spoke any English very much. So we used to have these picture books. And I remember this one poster when I was a kid, there was like this two roads like split in half, and there was one road going towards hell and one road going to heaven. And they had this picture of, you know, clean living and whatnot going towards heaven. On the other side, they had corroborees, playing cards, drinking, smoking, and, you know, that road was leading towards hell. And one of the pictures I remember, actually, there was one picture book they used to have. I don't know what it was about. They used to have this picture. It was of a beer can, a big, giant beer can, in chains, chained up to an Aboriginal man, leading him towards hell.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Just one can?
Yeah, one can.
Oh, mate, if I was going to hell, I'd want a slab.
Yeah, me too. But Christianity was a funny thing, you know. My grandfather actually became a preacher. So he somehow, I don't know, I think he got some of his language mixed up, though, you know, because he couldn't really translate the Bible into Walmajeriwangajungakukajanyiganamangali. Oh, you know, we had so many different languages. But I remember one time when I was small, and he was actually giving us a sermon, and he was talking about Noah and the big flood, you know, the big flood. My grandfather was there and he was going, yes, even rain blah 40 days and 40 night, and even rain every day and every night. And he got really carried away and he started speaking in language and he reckoned, yes, ngababa wandinya, God duba ngaba wandinya, tarabinya ba ngaba, papa nyirlil mandinya, nyirlil mandinya mean. And we all started cracking up because what he actually said was, yes, God sent this flood. It was a fucking big bastard. And that's why, you know, Christianity was like a ground for just comic. It was just very comical.
Oh, man. I remember going to school and we used to have religious instruction at school here, right?
Yeah.
Man, I'll tell you about religious instruction in the 70s. Every day when religious instruction come on, me, the Jew and the Arab got to go pick up rubbish for an hour. Oh, we love that stuff, man. But, you know, Christianity, man, they're cool, man. Yeah, Jesus was cool, man. What did the long hair and the robe action and the sandals? What did we get? We get some fat guy sitting in the bottom of a tree, eat sticks and dirt for 40 days, can't even lose weight.
You know, I lived in Sydney for a little while. I went over there for a little while. I was living there, studying, you know, dancing. I knew this fellow once. His name was David Rogers. He was a good photographer. Anyway, you know, he was there when I was there in the beginning. And I remember when my family came and visited me in Sydney, my jabbi, which is my grandmother, my grandfather, my jaja, my grandmother, and my mum and dad, not my dad, my mum and my aunties and all that. They were doing, like, traditional dancing and they came over. And because I come from a small community, all, you know, my jabbi, my grandfather, thinks that I know everybody in Sydney. You know, like, you know everybody in Fitzroy Crossing. You know everyone. They're related to you. So jabbi think that I know everyone in Sydney. So he's never been there. So I decided, you know what, I'm going to take him to Centre Point Tower to show him how big Sydney is. And I don't know everybody in the Sydney town. So I took him down. We went down to Sydney to the Centre Point Tower to, you know, we got there. And my grandfather and I arrived earlier than everyone else. So Mum and everybody came later. Finally, they all got there. And then by the time it was for us to go up, because I said to my jabbi, to my grandfather, you know what, jabbi? We're going to go right up the top there, where you get them one place, where you're going to have mangari, and you go wamarn and wamarn and wamarn. That means there's a revolving restaurant up there where you can eat some food. So I said, we'll go up there. So we got there, everybody said, come on, let's go. Now we're going to get into this lift and go up to the top there. You know, my jabbi stopped, grabbed my hand really hard and said, nah, Ningali, I'm not going. And I reckon, why, jabbi? Why don't you go and come get me in up top where we're going to go to that place up Mangari? And I reckon, nah, well, I've been looking at that door. I've been sitting down and I've been looking at that door. That door even open. And that man even go in. And that another one door even open. And that woman even come out. I don't want to change into a woman.
No, he was in Sydney.
True. You know, I live with your mob.
Where do you live with
mob? Footscray.
Footscray, hey, really? Yeah. You know what they reckon about Footscray?
What?
It's like the Asian holiday for the unemployed.
Good feed, though.
Good feed.
Oh. So, you know what? I'm not trying to be rude or racist or anything like that, but I've got to tell you one thing.
What?
Mate, you mob don't know how to drive. You know, I was standing the other day watching somebody park a car, and I'm looking at him, looking, and I'm getting really frustrated. Just let me park your car, please. You know, you mob know how to make them, yeah. But you must have known how to drive them.
We learn how to drive like that.
True God.
Yeah, it's tradition. It is. No, it's true. Have you ever driven behind a Vietnamese guy? And he's going 30. And you go to pass him. And he goes, whoa. And he slows down. You know what he's doing? He's looking in his rear vision mirror and he's waiting for you to get really mad. So when you start honking your horn, he slows down. And he goes, whoa. We learned that stuff. Yeah. It's called kung fu driving. Yes. Driving when not driving. Yeah.
So, did you ever go back to Vietnam?
Yeah, man. I go back all the time, hey. I go back there. And I can't, it's weird. I can't really speak. I speak language like a 7-year-old kid, you know. So the only thing I can say there is, ma, ma, con mới ỉa rồi. Which means, mum, I just pooed my pants.
Hey, you know, Well, you should teach me your language, Vietnamese.
Oh, no, man. Vietnamese is too hard for you white people, man. It's a tonal language, Vietnamese, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of like six accents. So I'll give you an example, right? There's a beer there called Ba Ba Ba. Right? Mm. It means 333. Ba is number three, right? It's called 333. And when I go back, I go to all these backpackers, right? And I wait for the backpackers to order beer. And I laugh. I have a good laugh. I sat next to one. He instead of saying, I'll have a Ba Ba Ba, he asked for a Ba Ba Ba. Which means, can I have three old aunties, please? And you don't want that, no. Man, you go back there, right? I should try and catch a bus. It's unbelievable. You catch a local bus, right? Vietnamese people don't have time to stop the bus, right? There's no bus stops in Vietnam. This is how you catch a bus. You just stand outside your house and put your thumb out. The bus comes burning past. The conductor opens the door. The bus doesn't even stop. It just goes... You, your bike, your chooks everywhere, right? It's unbelievable. And, you know, you go there. You know in Footscray when they have those blue eggs? You know what they are?
No.
Have you had one of them in Footscray?
No. They're blue.
They're blue, right? Because these eggs are like, they're duck eggs.
Oh.
Yeah. And the ducks are they're not strong enough. They're too weak to hatch.
Yeah, yeah.
So instead of throwing them out, Vietnamese people just boil them up, right? And just eat them. So what you do, you boil them up and you take off the top of it. And it's about six layers of egg in there. So you put some salt and pepper in. You get your spoon, you go through it. And in the middle... There's a fetus, right?
Yeah.
With big eyes like this, big duck fetus, big eyes, and black hair, wet hair, everything, right? And so you get your spoon and you just take its head off and you just, it's beautiful. Duck season is a piece of piss in Vietnam. We don't even let them hatch.
It sounds like it. You might play cricket?
Yeah, man, I play cricket. Yeah. I'm the world's fastest yellow man. Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. What this where the Aboriginal cricket players?
Hey, did you know that the first Australian team to ever go to England was an Aboriginal team?
Yeah, really?
Yep. Yeah. An all Aboriginal team. They went over to Lords in the 19 or 1800s or something.
Yeah, right. How come there's no cricket? How come there's no Vietnamese and no Asian and Aboriginal cricket players, eh?
Nah. It's all right though, we might get some.
Yeah.
Just lucky that Pauline Hanson didn't get into power.
Oh, when she gets
imagine in. Imagine if she was Prime Minister.
Oh, mate, if Pauline Hanson was Prime Minister, she'd kick us all out. Yeah. She hates us people.
Hey, I made up a song about Paulie.
You made a song?
Yeah.
Right.
You want to hear?
Yeah, show me.
It goes like this. I just made it up just then, actually.
Yeah, go on.
It's like Dolly Parton. You know Dolly Parton? You know that song?
Yeah.
It goes, Pauline, 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 I'm begging of you, please don't take my land. With fiery hair and eyes so blue, you got gammon smile, you talk bullshit too.
And don't muck around because you're messing with black and tram. Yeah. Yeah, nice.
Yeah, nah. I'm glad she's not in power.
Mate, if she's in
power, redhead is good enough.
There. She's going to she's gonna kick us all out. You know that?
True.
Yeah. She wants to kick us all out. So you know what I'm going to do?
What?
I'm going to go to my shed, right? Yeah. I'm going to get my boat back out.
Mm-hmm.
I kept it. I'm going to dust it off. Right?
Yeah. And seal it.
I'm going to seal it. And me and you, we get on the boat and we do a reverse reenactment.
Yeah.
And we go back to Vietnam.
Yeah, we can go back to Vietnam. You know what? Yeah. Maybe we can start up a bush tucker restaurant. Vietnamese bush tucker restaurant.
Yeah, we start up a restaurant. Hey, instead of surf and turf,
we'll
do kelp and kelpie.
We could have like shrimps and chimps.
Shrimps and chimps. We can throw another chimp on the barbie.
Yeah. But what would we call our restaurant?
I got a name for it.
True.
Yeah. The Abo Asian Restaurant.
Aberration.
Yeah.
Oh, I like that. Yeah. I like that.
Hey. Oh, looks like the pub's closing, hey?
Yeah.
We better like go. Hey, you want to go to another pub?
Yeah.
All right. Share a cab, right?
Yeah.
All right.
Well, you can go and stand to the... Grab the taxi. I'll go get... behind the tree.
All right. Thank you, Hung. Thank you, Ning Lee. Great work.
Thank you very much.
Friend. No. We got one more thing to say.
One more last thing.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Patrick, for having us.
Thank you. Beautiful.
Usually when we did the show, we haven't done the show, by the way, for 8 years. So it's been a long time since then. One thing we do is, like, at the end of the show, because this show is about talking about what is Australia or whatever. So what I've done, what we usually do is I've written a poem. There's a poem that I wrote for my son. He was 1 year old at the time, but now he's like 20. And I wrote a show for him telling, I couldn't give him anything, so I gave him what I could. And what I gave him was what this country means to me. And now I want to give this poem and share it with you guys and give it to you guys. And I've written it in English and in Wurundjeri. So I'll say it in Wurundjeri first, which is my traditional language from the Great Sandy Desert in the Kimberley. And it goes like this. It's called My Firstborn, and it goes like this. Nyundu ngayugura bari. Yungumrana ngayo ngamaji ongora. Nyundu ngayugura bari. Yungumrana ngayo jamidi wirgil. Nyundu ngayugura bari. Yungumrana ngayo jaja omunda. Nyundu ngayugura bari. Yungumrana ngayo ngabudulbo. Minyadi baji ngayo munda ngamanakangani. To you, my fellow Australian, I give you my mother's land. To you, my fellow Australians, I give you my grandfather's pride. To you, my fellow Australians, I give you my grandmother's wisdom. To you, my fellow Australians, I give you my father's love. For these are the things most precious to me, so keep them close to your heart. Thank you.
Well, there's proof, if you need it, that we can cover a lot of ground here, especially with humour and everything else. And we're about to cover a little more with our next guest, a caustic caricaturist, 4 times Walkley Award winner and widely published cartoonist, a drawer of lines, a draftsman of the human condition. He is the one and only Peter Nicholson.
So what I'm going to do is... draw for about 20 minutes. You'll have to be a little bit patient because sometimes when I'm drawing, I lose the thread of what I'm saying, and sometimes when I'm talking, I lose the thread of what I'm drawing. But my object is to look at the question of identity from the cartoonist's point of view, pretty simply, and I'm starting off with a sort of an image which was made famous by Sidney Nolan, but I'm going to draw it in a different way. So, basically, let's make this black. It's a pretty simple sort of a drawing, really. this was the original sort of figure which talked to us about identity, because this is so, you can look at it in lots of different ways, but as a cartoonist, I guess I'm always thinking, how does a politician look at the question of identity? And of course, politicians are always seeking identity. They can't get enough of it, really. So it's a word that means so many different things. And one of the things is it's just the outer shell of a person, the way and what you see when you look at them. It's a sort of the initial protection against a landscape. I'll put a bit of landscape in here. Just a bit of a mountain range here, maybe. And I might colour this in Don't know how these colours will come up. A little bit of... There you go, it's pretty good. Some sky. And a bit of desert. So, now... Identity means so many things. Everyone has to have one. Now, just to illustrate that, I've been drawing a lot of these lately. So I just put a bit of a nose here. And a bit of a forehead here, ear sort of coming out like this. Bit of an eye. And couple of legs down here like this with two toes. Okay. So now the reason I've drawn this cow is to make the point that everyone has to have an identity now. So even, you know, this poor animal. And people change their identity. They can change their identity. So this is, we're talking about identity on the surface here. So let's imagine we put on, you know, a ridiculous wig, like this. And, you know, take our suitcase. And, you know, we just head off to Greece, for argument's sake. So that's a case of, obviously, a forged identity. You can get away with it for so long, but eventually you get caught. Now, why I like this image is that this is the way that, you know, that politicians look at it, I believe. Because what they want to do is to project an image which everyone can recognise. Preferably, it's an identity which doesn't reveal too much about them. It's just sort of protection against the outside environment, against the outside world. You deflect awkward questions and so on. Of course, the question that we as the electorate would like to ask, you know, is what's inside? Kind of, it's really, you know, there's nobody at home. So it's a classic case of the lights are on but nobody's home. Now, so what the cartoonist sort of tries to do all the time is to peer into the, behind the first level of identity to the real identity. And we always talk, you know, about people losing their identity or finding their true identity. So somewhere there is an identity in there somewhere with most people. So it's something, would be something like this, I guess, if all going well. So there we are. There is somebody home. You know, so I'm just going to save that and get rid of that one. Now, the archetypal version of a durable politician, in my experience going back, you know, over the different prime ministers that we've all experienced, managed to achieve the amazing feat of being the inside and the outside being completely the same. In other words, what you see is what you get. So he convinced everyone that his real identity was the identity which we saw. You'll probably recognise him pretty soon when I start drawing. Looks pretty much the same as the first one, I know, but this one is a bit different. And, you know, legs, probably not that long. And the eyebrows. Yeah. So now I guess you've all guessed who this is, but I'm going to fill in a bit of the landscape behind behind him because he came on the scene as the leader of the opposition at a time when the landscape was full of rather charismatic and hostile things. So we put in a couple of eyebrows in here, like this. And sort of an eye a bit like that. Now a few wrinkles across here, normally. And sort of quite big ears, a few lines around here, and a sort of very charismatic bit of addition up here, which is very important. So now there's part of your landscape. We come down a bit further down the mountain, and here's another bit. So I've got a sort of a forehead a bit like this, a couple of eyebrows again, but not quite as pronounced, and eyes are sort of like this. And the nose kind of comes out like this. And sort of cheekbones like this. Now you have this sort of strange mouth that Paul Keating had, and this sort of collapsing bottom half of the face. And little ears, and a bit of hair up here. Now, an important ingredient which I haven't kind of put in here is I'll just add that in. Don't know how the colours are coming up there. A little bit of 6 o'clock shadow. Okay, so now just to finish the landscape off. Now, we know that, you know, these two fell out. We know the whole history of the long Labor government there, and eventually the landscape sort of altered. And so I'll just make a few little changes here. So we had a sort of a collapse, I guess you'd say, here in the landscape. And this bit sort of went all down here. Now, so this was the moment, the totally unexpected moment, when John Howard came to the prime ministership. So I think this was 1996. All the way through to 2007. And there he goes. So I'll now go on to another little fresh bit of paper. This one is very much to do with identity. This particular character was a caricature I made for a puppet. And actually, here he is coming out of his mould in my studio, coming out as a rubber figure. So we kind of gave him an identity. Hello. Like this. I just have to give me a minute to get this sorted out. There we go. Put a bit of a scarf there for him. And, computer's running away with me here. And those colours are all escaping, but that's a navy blue scarf. And we always used to kind of give him a collection of cigarettes like this. of course, in the other hand, he'd have a beer. And in these fingers, he'd have a couple of extra cigarettes. I just... the interesting thing was that... I better give him a beating, hadn't I? The interesting thing was that he was once interviewed about this caricature of him, and he thought it was very unfair because he said we made him appear like a sort of an uncouth person with no manners, and then he swore that he'd never used the expression pig's ass and never would. So what he was kind of accusing me of was making a false identity for him and imposing it on him. Now, if you could do that, I think that would be the greatest, you know, triumph that a cartoonist could achieve, probably. But it wasn't true, really. All we gave him was his own identity back again. Next week is the anniversary of the fall of Kevin Rudd and the rise of Julia Gillard. And my caricature of her is sort of based on a little short bit of video that I saw repeated over and over again on the night when these negotiations were taking place, where she was walking across the passage into Kevin Rudd's office and then the ABC would show her coming out again and going back in again, and just this particular walk that she had. So I draw her kind of like this. Sort of with, obviously, a lot of red hair. Eyes kind of like this. And a very long neck. I mustn't forget the earlobes. And so this is literally based on the way I saw that video. It seemed to me that this is the way she walked. Now, we'll put a little bit of red there. Now, I still haven't been able to work out how to draw the real Julia. I'm still working on that. But I know it's going to be there somewhere. But the interesting thing, you notice I haven't drawn her in with some, you know, with a Ned Kelly mask on. But I'm going to just bring in a little element here. So here we go. This is really how I see it. Put in these square boxes here and put in some feet here. And likewise here. A few hands happening here, a bit of extra pressure here. So that's sort of my cartoon view of what happened on that night. I don't know whether it's correct or not. Now, one more drawing, Julia Gillard's adversary. So I'll start off with this sort of familiar image. So that's pretty straight ahead. And just add a bit of clothing. Now, I've got to put in a little bit of the landscape, so I'll do that. Oh, that colour's not coming up very... Looks like he's got purple ears, doesn't it? So it can't be helped. Oh. The colours just aren't reproducing, but... So what we have here, and I know I'm taking these figures from a poll in our paper just the other day, Julia Gillard's popularity as Prime Minister has sort of kind of been going like this. At the same time, Tony Abbott's has been sort of going like this. But strangely enough, it's still below Julia's, which is sort of, you know, telling you something. So now, whether Tony will ever get to be, Prime Minister or to run at the next election, I don't know, because I kind of have the feeling that, unlike Howard, he doesn't seem to be able to convince us that the outside shell is the same as the identity inside. And I don't know whether this is a good formula for politics these days, so I'm kind of thinking maybe... he might be making a visit to the Knackery before the next election, but then on the other hand, he may not. I don't have any ability to foresee these things. So that's it from me.
I might start with one, if we haven't got one just yet. Come on over. Come on down. Are there places that humour shouldn't go? Or do we need humour to go to places?
Sorry, I didn't hear you.
Well, I never wanted to go that one.
Yeah.
The curious thing is working in print, in a newspaper, that... the sort of standards of politeness and decency which newspapers seem to require, because it's in black and white and it sits on the breakfast table and children see it, they, you know, have very sort of strict standards, completely different to the web and to television indeed. So it's not really a problem that I face a lot of the time, although the only thing you could say is that sometimes cartoonists are unfair to politicians. I don't know whether...
Oh, no.
People think that.
I don't think so. But you have cartoons turned down?
On the grounds of taste, cartoons are often turned down because anything that I put in that's pretty, borderline, they will just say, no, we just don't print, we don't print rude words or rude pictures, really.
Yeah. And do you guys self-censor as performers, as comedians? Do you think of a joke and think, better not go there, or is there another way?
Oh, if you wait long enough, it's okay. But I'm doing what I do. doing what I do in the climate of where we're living now, it's a lot of people get offended very easily. Every time someone says something, somebody's offended by something, you know. So, and this is the... I think this is the last job where I can go on stage and say whatever I want and get away with it. And people come and they watch my shows and they go, well, this is what we want to say at work, but we're not allowed.
Exactly.
So, so this is one of the last places where I can do whatever I want and get away with it. But, you know, I don't do tasteless jokes. Just I do more... Well, one of the thing about comedy is we take the piss out of people in power and we don't really take the piss out of people with no power. Mm. And that's sort of what, you know, I try and do.
And do we? Is that
we
a new
also laugh? I think we laugh with Indigenous laughing in Indigenous. We've had so many things. There's nothing else we can do but laugh. Mm. You know, we laugh at ourselves, and then in turn make other people, you know, laugh. It's okay, you know. Mm. But yeah. Sometimes people are like, oh, should I laugh? Especially when I say the Adam and Eve joke, and everyone, should I laugh? Yeah. Oh, wait, yeah. But it's funny, you know? Yeah. So, yeah, I think people get a bit too caught up in that. What do you say? It's that, what's that word? Yeah, it's just like people get too caught up, sensitivity of it
yeah,
all.
In
you know?
The
There's no
correctness.
Room to laugh anymore.
Yeah.
And being an Aboriginal person, I think people, because you don't see very many Indigenous comedians, there's quite just you know a few of us out there, but it's good to laugh at us for a change, for us to laugh at what we you know, we want to show you. We want to be able to bring that out and show it to the wider community, I suppose.
Mm. Yeah. And is there a difference between black and white humour then?
Oh, so much so. Because majority of the Indigenous humours I hear from white people are racist jokes, do you know? So we try to change that around to make you fellas... Because when I hear it, you know, people go... I mean, I hear jokes like, oh, what, you know, what do you call a boomerang doesn't come back? You know, stick. Everybody would have heard that, you know? So, but for us to turn it around and they can make us feel comfortable. But when I start saying it, I'll make them feel real comfortable. But I'll turn around and say, look, it's okay to laugh. You know, it's okay. It's cool.
What I do is that people keep coming up to me all the time and say, look, you know, it's great. Yeah, you people laugh at yourselves. I don't really... What I do is that I take the piss out of you.
Making fun of us.
But you don't know it.
Yeah.
Until you get home.
Yeah.
And you wake up half... We wake up in the morning and go, fuck, he was taking the piss out of me then. Yeah.
But that's what our comedy is based on, is the misconception of what people think of Hung and I. You know, when people see Hung, they wouldn't know if he's Vietnamese. They brand him as an Asian, so he can be Chinese, Japanese, whatever. But he's got that Asian features. I can be, you know, I'm an Aboriginal person, but yet we've had 40,000 years, 60,000 years of culture, and there was an amazing group of language and people. So you don't know if I'm Murray, you don't know if I'm Koori, you don't know if I'm Wurundjeri, if I'm, you know, so those kind of things. So we're actually taking the piss out of ourselves for you taking the piss out of us. Just make you think about it, you know, think about it a bit. So it's misconception. Like I said, Vietnamese, you know, he's religion and he's making assumptions, you know. I mean, I've been asked, I mean, I remember, I mean, I've been speaking English for a very long time and I remember doing this show for a bunch of, you know, in Perth for a show and we all were there doing a show called Brand New Day. And they were sponsoring us, this group, they were sponsoring us. They came and asked us how long we've been speaking English for. You know, I said, nah, we only just learned it today, just for humour.
Yeah. Quick learners.
Yeah, you know, make them feel really special.
And when you're not in Australia, when you're outside, does the material change? Do you change the way you tell jokes? Is there a particular Australian way of performing?
We're always, Hung and I always just...
When we go overseas, we try and be even more Australian.
I know, it's really weird though. Yeah,
the Australian sense of humour is different to... Yeah, because I go to Asia all the time now, and Asia is just... Stand-up comedy is just booming in Asia now. Mm. But I go there and I don't change anything. I try and even be even more Aussie, even speak with a Queensland accent.
Even does have yourself fish and chips.
But that's what people want to know. People want to hear what's coming out of your country. Yeah. People don't want you to turn up and say words that they know. You know, they want to know what's come out of Australia.
Yeah.
You know? So this is what's coming out, you know, so...
It's like, you know, being in the States, when I was in the States, I was asked, you know, what... They didn't even pick Australian. They went Puerto Rican, you know, Jamaican, you know, all this, and they didn't even come up with Australia. And when I said, no, I'm Australian, but you don't have an Australian accent, you know?
Yeah.
So, and I was like... But,
not as much as mine.
No, not as much as yours. So... But it was really weird, and when I did tell them that I was Australian, they were like, oh, I didn't realise there was black people in Australia. So that kind of thing. So it's really bizarre.
And you two have travelled a lot in the bush. Is there a bush humour that is different to the city humour that
you find? It is. I mean, even you know, we toured the Kimberley and we toured, like, Pilbara and, like, we did shows for loggers and protesters and miners and whatnot. especially with my mob, the Aboriginal people from where I come from in the Kimberley were like coming up to Hong and saying, "Hey, you're Bruce Lee for brother, eh?" You know? That's probably the only Asian they knew was Bruce Lee. And then they have Hong turn up and he goes, "Yeah, Bruce Lee for brother." Like asking him to do kung fu and all this kind of stuff. So. But it was just really interesting to see that they got the humour. Because I don't know if anybody knows the history of Broome. It's a very multicultural Asian and Aboriginal, and it's a melting pot of so many different cultures there. So we're used to having an Asian influence, you know, in the northern part of Australia. So that wasn't really new. So it was like, you know, people were, they were really...
Yeah, when we were in, what was that place you were talking about before then?
Walpole. Yeah.
And it's this little town, right? And we turned up there and it was just in the hall and it was just, you get all these old people with the purple hair and the Ugg boots sitting up the front. And you got these hippies who lived in trees. You had these loggers. You had all these communists. You had all these people who hate one another, right? But they came to see our show, and for 2 hours, everyone thought they were Australian. Hey,
yeah.
It was
they
unbelievable.
Loved it. Yeah, they even made us judge their wine.
Yeah.
Oh, it's good.
So so with this thing, with this festival. We've seen it happen in Australia when people just get together and go, "We're all Australian," just for 2 hours. The next day they might be killing each other, I don't know.
Chopping down the
while you're there.
Yeah, chopping down trees where the hippies were living and stuff like that, you know. But
So this one's for all three of you, probably starting with you, Peter. As humour mongers, I'm always interested in someone who makes a living from humour. At which point did you decide, "I'm gonna do this? I'm not gonna have a proper job."
Yeah.
And my friends may laugh, my parents may disapprove.
Well, I always just wanted a job where I could just sit and read the newspaper most of the day. So it just kind of seemed like a good idea. But I guess with this sort of thing, you just really go from job, you know, you go for a job somewhere, and if you get it, you get it, and you just keep that as long as you can. And, you know, as long as people I've been lucky in a way because newspapers have always been under a certain amount of threat, first from television when I first started, and now, of course, from the web. So they're looking around, what can they put in a newspaper that's not just slabs of print? So I guess the fact that, you know, I could earn a living as a cartoonist seemed like a great thing to happen to me, you know. So that's the way, I think that's the way nearly all humorists work. They go from job to job.
Prepared to do it.
Yeah, if you can get paid, you know, good.
Yeah. Even better, it's a bonus.
Well, I started off wanting to be a ballerina, I mean, you can't tell now. They have, like, you know, the ballet in Fitzroy Crossing. But I think what I really wanted to, like, I wanted to see an Indigenous influence or some sort of an Indigenous input in whether it be the stage, whether it be film, whether it be thing, and I've done both stage and film and this. So it was like a matter of, just for me, it was more of a discovery thing for myself personally. I just wanted to see if people knew much about Indigenous humour. You know, I remember I did a show, like you got reserved there. I saw us did a show in Adelaide and I said, "Oh, they shouldn't have. How did they know I live on a reserve?" You know? So those kind of things. You know, those kind of things. So I wanted to see that kind of reaction and see, if, you know, to make humour out of those kind of things.
As a kid?
Yeah, well, as a kid, because I grew up in a reserve, you know. Yeah. I grew up getting rations. My father was a stockman. And, and you know, I lived in a time that was forever changing. And I think one of the big things, was my contribution, is wanting to make that change, I suppose, to teach other people.
More so. Which you're still doing.
I think.
Yeah. And Hung, at which point did you decide to take the plunge?
I come here and, you know, all the Vietnamese kids who come here, all the Asian kids, all they want to be is become doctors, you know. And now I just go to them, man, laughter is the best medicine. It's better than doctor medicine without the book learning, you know. So, you know, and, you know, I only work half an hour a day, so... But when I first started... I wanted to tell my boat story and growing up in Australia and growing up in Saigon and the boat story, and I didn't want it to make it like a whinging sort of sad story because I was only 9 years old, so I wanted to say it from a 9-year-old kid's point of view, but with an Australian sense of humour, So Australians would laugh at it. Mm. Australians don't like it when you start whinging, you know. So, yeah, so that's how I started learning about it, doing humour, doing, you know, refugee stories for a laugh.
And what did your family think?
And people laughed at it.
And your family said?
My parents said, do whatever you like, yeah, really, just as long as you don't sell smack, you know. Because, yeah, my dad was an artist. My dad's an artist and my mum was an artist, so they just let me do whatever I want, you know. So I started in the street here playing the violin when I was 15. So I started busking here when I was 15. Mm. And then the recession hit it really hard, so... And I couldn't get any work as a musician, so I thought I'd go and do some stand-up.
So it's a long tradition.
It was pretty... Yeah, it was poverty that made me do stand-up, yeah.
Oh, we got a few. Yes, we're down the front here.
Yes, could I ask... Sorry.
Just here.
Wondering if I could ask Peter in particular if he could tell us some of the politicians that he's found particularly difficult to draw, if that has happened. And then a second part to that is I think you were sort of mentioning in part that a caricature can almost become the reality of a person. And so the second part would be, can you give an example of a caricature actually tending to take on a life of its own and become the politician?
I can't think of anyone whose career I've launched, actually. but a lot of people are very, you know, just very hard to draw, especially when they first appear on the scene and people aren't really familiar with them. So, you know, ideally, the ideal politician for me is someone, you know, who's got extremely craggy eyebrows, an enormous nose, a large jaw, big stick-out ears. You know, that to me, that would be a good, you know, a good start. I found Kevin Rudd terribly hard to draw at first, and I think all cartoonists did. And slowly, if you look at all the cartoons, of all the caricatures of a politician as they become known to the public, they all sort of slowly change, and they tend to pick on the same things. I don't know whether they're all looking over each other's shoulder or whether they just find that, you know, any face only has a certain number of features that are different from all the other faces out there. And you sort of pick on those. As for the interesting thing about, you know, some politicians collect cartoons, but they often like to collect the first two or three that are done of them, and then they quickly tire of it, I've noticed. So, you know, I don't think they really like being... I think they get their staff to read the cartoons, probably.
And up the back there... Up the row on the left. Philip Ruddock, he's a big collector, isn't he?
He is a big collector, yes. He's bought several of mine.
Thank you. This is a question for Hung, and I'm pretty sure it refers to you. But about a decade ago, there was a program on the ABC about political correctness, and they played an extract of a Vietnamese comedian imitating a Vietnamese driving instructor, and it was brilliant. Was one of the funniest things I've ever heard. And apparently, if my memory serves me correctly, that had been performed at a venue somewhere in Sydney and people had complained about it as being racist and anti-Vietnamese. So I just... If it was you, I think it was brilliant. And I hope you do it. I hope you do it again sometime. But the other thing that I wanted to ask you was... What do you do when you're performing to a Vietnamese audience or to a Vietnamese-speaking audience? What do you say about the whiteys?
with the Asian driving thing, a current affair used to ring me up every year at the same time every year, and they go, Hung, it's time. It's time. So every year I do a bad Asian driver, and they take me out to Victoria Parade and make me drive really slowly during peak hour. And and they would film that, you know. Well, Asians are bad drivers, I don't know, man. It's true. Because
it's like organised chaos over there, though.
Yeah, because they can't see through all the tissue boxes and all the... and all the lucky charms. They're driving on karma. the Vietnamese people. And it's true. What's the other one?
What do you do when you...
Oh, to Vietnamese people? I really don't work to Vietnamese people. They don't laugh at my jokes. No, Vietnamese people are very proud of what I do, but they've got worse stories than me. So they go, mate, we've heard it all. And, it's very hard to do a Vietnamese show. I try, really, really try not to do it. I do most of my things to the general public and not just the Vietnamese people. Because, they've heard it all.
We've got a question here.
There's one file away up the top there.
Oh, up the top, didn't spot him. Sorry.
Up there.
We'll go back up there, sorry, yes.
Just hanging out.
Hi, I'm Tim. I'm an aspiring comedian as well. I'm actually an expat from Singapore, from Asia. And so, I mean, noting that stand-up skits and even satire, they are tools of social commentary. But as an outsider, can I ask whether do you guys see it as an outlet to fit in with the Australian national identity?
I think for me personally, it's not so much me fitting with the national identity. I think you fellas have to fit in my identity. It's a sense of humour. I mean, that, like, this, just answer this. When I go back and perform with my mob, they always finish my jokes. So it's not worth performing at home for me. But, it's like more like we talk, you know, we've had a pretty terrible history in this country. And I think people need to start recognise that Aboriginal people have been the first people. And through comedy is the only way that we can sort of, you know, just to make things light of things and start getting to learn. I think that's the way I sort of think. If people need to learn, that's an identity that's already here, the Aboriginal people. And to be able to laugh at that, at our injustices, I suppose, is a good thing. Because we need to laugh. Otherwise, we'll all, you know, it's going to be a sad, sad country otherwise.
Yeah, so. I think you have to use... It's an advantage. You have to use your difference to as your advantage, really. And you have an advantage over people who are exactly the same as what people think you should be. Mm. So if you're different, man, that's the shit. You know? You can come from another point of view where other people don't really see. You know, so, if I were you, I'd use what I have as your advantage.
And just here.
Well, Australians really appreciate a good sense of humour. I think it's global. There is precedence, quite a history in using humour to break down racial divides and racism. Some examples that come to mind: Bill Cosby in the States. Worked beautifully in breaking down racial tensions in the States. Alf Garnett in the UK was the rampant racist, but turned that on its head, in effect. Locally, we've had precedents like Ernie Dingo, brilliantly breaking down those racial tensions that are in most countries, I think. So I think it's a global thing, I really do. I think there is a history of humour breaking down those barriers.
Yeah.
And just here.
Seamus McManus, I don't suppose you're able to tell where I'm from, of course. And I was just so pleased to listen to everything you had to say, because I was trying to become a comedian. In fact, I was thinking of becoming a comedian. And of course, I can't find any jokes, so could you please help me out?
Actually, when I went and did I did a show in Edinburgh. I was at the Edinburgh Festival. But at the time, I had to get out of the UK. And so I ended up going to Ireland. And I was in Dublin, and I went to this pub, and that's where I learned to drink Guinness, and I absolutely love it. But I was like still trying to pick where I was from, and then I turned around and said, I'm from Australia. And then, but it was really weird because Irish people are like, oh, you're the real followers, aren't I? That's right. We got treated the same by the English, so you can come and drink with us. You know, so it was great to feel welcome in a room full of white people and drinking Guinness.
Well, I think you're funny looking, so you're halfway there.
Well, there you go.
You got to use it, man. You're halfway there. Don't worry about it.
There's the material. He's got you started. And over this side. Yeah, oh, we've got a mic, yep.
This depends on whether you're familiar with Angry Boys, a series that's on ABC at the moment.
We were just talking about that.
Yeah, I'm just interested in your opinions about how that presents Australian identity, and it's about to start airing in the US, so how you think it will go over there, or whether you think it's a specific brand of Australian comedy that may not reach overseas.
Well, that's really hard. I think they tried to do Captain Kim in the States, didn't they?
They're remaking it in the States.
Are they?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know.
Well, I think it might work, you know, because it's a weird thing. You try. I reckon he shouldn't try and change anything. Let's just see what happens, you know. See what happens. You know, they don't see that sort of stuff over there. So hopefully it might work. Because, you know, well, Wilfred's gone over there and he's been Wilfred, but he had to change, you know, everything else. But he's still him. So hopefully, comedy here with. Hopefully we don't have to change it when we go. Yeah, in the future, I hate it when Americans change things just because they can't understand it. I don't understand that, you know.
It makes it that we can't understand what they're doing to our comedy.
Mm. Well, it's a kind of insecurity that we feel the need to change, I suppose. Yeah. Whereas American comedians don't. They don't feel that.
No, they don't feel that at all. Because, you know,
I just hope. I mean, Chris Lilley is an amazing man. I mean, his mind is brilliant. I mean, to be able to come up with characters like that. I mean, my favourite is Summer Heights High, you know. Fantastic. I love that show. And but the way he thinks, it's amazing that he really captures, you know, Australia in the sense that, especially the what do you say, the groups of people, where you come from, you know, you can identify with where they come from. So good luck to him. And it's going to be a task, like anything, going to the States. I don't even see why you have to go to the States to break it. You know, I think you can do it here.
No, and you've got to get paid.
I know you get paid, but our money's worth a bit more than them now.
Yeah, but, you know, there's much more of that stuff. But, yeah, hopefully he'll open the door for a lot of us with just Australian comedy going over there. Because there hasn't been any Australian comedians that have broken America at all, except for Paul Hogan, really, and Dame Edna, you know, so... Hopefully he'll open some doors for us to get our TV stuff over there. And if he doesn't, I'll be right behind him.
One question down here? Sure. Can we have a microphone down here?
I didn't actually have a question. I was asking you, Mr. Chairman, could you call for one last question?
Oh, that's your question. That was your question? We've got a question up the back there. Good question. Thank you, Patrick.
Hi, thank you very much for your stimulating presentations. A question of someone who did make it big in the States was Mark Oliphant, the cartoonist, who was considered the best cartoonist in the States in the 50s and 60s. And at the same time, David Lowe was considered the best cartoonist in Britain. And both of them first cut their cartooning teeth in Australia. And a particular question for you, Peter, was there something about Australian cartooning that, or were these just two remarkable individuals who established such a presence?
Yeah, well Oliphant had certainly a lot of enormous success, and he was copied widely by a lot of American cartoonists. But actually... I mean, there are a very large number of good cartoonists in America, in all the, because there are so many mid-sized papers around the country, and there's an awful lot of bad cartoonists, I think, probably too. But it's not quite what we imagine, that, you know, Australian cartoonists are kind of, you know, the, the best in the world. I think I think it's the Australian cartooning got off to a good start because in the early days people, you know, they didn't have art galleries and things in Australia. They had magazines which were brought out from England in the post, and they read Punch and they read all these things, and so sort of, there was a natural desire to copy this type of art, and there was an obviously natural freedom in the colonies then, you know, to express pretty radical ideas, and so we got off to a good start. You know, Oliphant is still you know, drawing and doing very well, and he was a big figure when he moved over there and made a big success.
Right. Well, I think we've covered a huge amount of ground and more or less discovered who we are in this ever-changing landscape. If we could, thank Hung Lee, Ning Lee Wolf, Peter Nicholson, and thank you all.